Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Matryoshka Memoirs, a story of Ukrainian forced labor, the Leica camera factory, and Nazi resistance. By Sasha Colby. Narrated by Allison Voller. Author's note. At least 12 million people were brought to Germany as forced laborers during World War II. Approximately three-quarters were civilian deportees, the rest prisoners of war. At its height, foreign forced labor accounted for roughly 20% of Germany's wartime workforce, the majority from Nazi-conquered territories in Central and Eastern Europe. In Hitler's Foreign Workers, Ulrich Herbert notes that in 1944, more than half of the Polish and Soviet civilian workers were female, their average age around 20. Replacement labor for German men fighting the war, foreign forced laborers were distributed among Germany's farms, mines, and factories. One of these factories, Ernst Leitz Optical Industry, known as Leitz Werke, belonged to the prominent Leitz family. The factory made optical equipment and Leica cameras crucial to Nazi military and propaganda efforts. Ernst Leitz II and his daughter, Elsie Kuhn Leitz, opposed the Nazi regime. However, under threat of detainment and company expropriation, Ernst Leitz II supplied the German military and staffed the factory with foreign forced labor. The camp was policed by the Gestapo. Elsie Kuhn Leitz, who had formerly worked in the Leitz company's accounting office, made herself responsible for overseeing the welfare of the factory's female Eastern workers. My maternal grandmother, Irina Kalinich Nikiforchuk, was one of them. This story is a combination of oral history, research, and imagination. Much of the historical dialogue has been fictionalized. Some chronologies have been condensed. Minor characters my grandmother remembered faintly have been fleshed out and named where not enough information was available. Others have been omitted. Elsie Kuhn Leitz's essay about the events of 1943 has been divided into sections, interwoven with details drawn from other first-person accounts of forced labor camps and women's prisons, and dramatized. June 1942. Summer light slips through the slats of the livestock car. Irina presses her cheek against the rough wood, seeking a cool breath of air beyond the heat and press of bodies. When the train stops, new prisoners are crowded in. All of them are young. Each day, the German soldiers give the prisoners one piece of dark bread and one cup of water. There are no latrines, only straw. And as the crowding intensifies, so does the stench. It is a smell that nauseates the prisoners and causes the guards to look more remote by the day. June 1942, Wetzlar, Germany. Elsie places the cover over her typewriter and returns the files to the metal cabinet beside her desk. Her movements are clipped, a way of managing tension over events now out of her control. The ability of two little girls to stay quiet, their mother's nerve at the border, the skill and discretion of the forger. When Maria appears in the doorway, Elsie tries not to startle. She locks the cabinet, drops the key into her jacket pocket, smooths her dark blonde hair with the flat of her hand. Maria's large blue eyes are full of questions, which Elsie deflects with her own. Have they rearranged the work units then? To keep the factory going? Maria shrugs. Change of plan, she says. Another train has arrived from the east. Part 1. For storytelling is always the art of repeating stories. and this art is lost when the stories are no longer retained. It is lost because there is no more weaving and spinning to go on while they are being listened to. The more self-forgetful the listener is, the more deeply is what he listens to impressed upon his memory. When the rhythm of work has seized him, he listens to the tales in such a way that the gift of retelling them comes to him all by itself. This, then, is the nature of the web in which the gift of storytelling is cradled. Walter Benjamin, The Storyteller. Arbeit macht frei. Work sets you free. Nazi concentration camp slogan. June 2011, Niagara Falls, Canada. I sit in the coolness of my grandmother's basement, laptop on the vinyl tablecloth facing the basement stove. A 40-watt bulb casts shadows on the wooden shelving crowded with jars of pickled beets and marinated banana peppers. Each year, my mother and I make this pilgrimage back east, leaving the breezes of the Pacific coast for my grandmother's house and the southern Ontario summer. Every year, I set up this temporary air-conditioned refuge, though when I was a child, these visits were marked by better ways of keeping cool. Ice cream sandwiches and cherry popsicles and watermelon wedges doled out by my grandmother with an indulgent, almost vengeful, satisfaction. One heat wave, the one that stands out like sun-streaked footage from a home movie, my grandparents bought a plastic wading pool and filled it with water from the garden hose. My three cousins and I, all girls, aged 3 to 7 at the time, threw off our sticky summer sundresses and jumped into the freezing water, our pulses racing as the icy water sloshed over the side and onto the closely cut lawn beneath. This shrieking glee lasted until the neighbor across the way phoned and threatened to call the police, confirming in my young mind that not only was suburban Ontario unmanageably humid, it was also ridiculously prohibitive. On the small west coast island my mother and I had come from, it was unusual for young children not to be naked at the beach. During parties, these same children would race through the orchard, climbing trees and picking golden plums from the highest branches until well into the August night. At the annual community salmon barbecue, we would form unsupervised packs, darting among the straw hats of longtime farming residents, the grass-stained sleeping bags of young families, and the patchouli-scented home-dyed fabrics of the Coho Drive contingent, who every year would spin in ecstatic circles to acoustic strumming from the plywood stage. What my grandparents thought of my parents' move to the coast during the wilds of the 70s, other than it was far, so far, I really couldn't say. My mother met my father when they were both teaching at a community college in Toronto. When teaching contracts dried up, they drove across the country in an Econoline van to seek their fortune out west. In a copper mining town on northern Vancouver Island, my father, long hair and all, was immediately hired to service the mine's giant Lectra hauls, those bright yellow monster trucks with their 10-foot tires. My mother drove the trucks he worked on through the hairpin turns between the pit and the refinery, or she did after threatening a lawsuit when all she was offered was secretarial work. This was 1973, after all, and things were changing, to the malicious displeasure of some of the other drivers, one of whom slipped LSD in her coffee before her midnight shift. This disaster in the making was interrupted by a flat tire on her truck, which meant she spent the night in the repair shop instead of on the road. The grimy walls of the repair shop were papered in centerfold posters, and my not-yet mother, 23 at the time, leaned against one of the giant tires until dawn, breathing in the distinctive odors of rubber, oil grease, and sweat, watching the model's enormous breasts magnify and retreat. On the bright side, my parents did make a great deal of money, which they promptly spent flying back and forth between Port Hardy and Vancouver, where restaurants and jazz bars filled the peninsula between the port and the bridges. Eventually, conceding they were not cut out for mining life, they found jobs at a small college on central Vancouver Island. On discovering that the best parties were on a still smaller island, 20 minutes ferry ride from their work, they bought a wooded piece of property on its western side, a part of the island invariably and disconcertingly termed the North End. When my grandmother first visited my parents' house with its vaulted wooden ceilings and skylights, a good 10-minute walk through leagues of Douglas fir from the closest neighbor, her only comment was that the windows would benefit from some nice lace curtains, a suggestion my mother has declined to act on for over 3 decades. My grandmother's preoccupation with lace has its own history, rooted in a bone-deep belief that lace symbolizes the triumph of civilization over barbarism, beauty over the brutal ugliness of poverty. As one who traveled from the fields of Stalin-starved Ukraine to a forced labor camp in Hitler's Germany, through DP camps to post-war Canada, she would know. Lace is everywhere in my grandmother's house. The curtains, the doilies, the dining room tablecloth. It is meant to be a barrier. As for me, someone who documents 20th century literary history for a living, I spend a lot of time in libraries and archives and similarly quiet, dimly lit places. Coming from a line of women who traveled far, so far, to get where they are, you might ask why I would choose this particular life. I can only speculate that born as I was at the western limit of the western coast, the only place to go was back. I tell you all this because I have become convinced that these movements, like overlapping flight routes in the in-flight magazine of the Boeing 767 that brought my mother and me here, are central to what happened next. All of it, the refugee swell out of the ruins of Europe, the post-war affluence, the restless sense of personal destiny of the 60s and 70s, the more ironic and often less expansive life path forged by my own generation, we strangely acquiescent captives of the millennium, led us to this point. To me, among the pickled beets, my mother and grandmother in the kitchen above organizing final details for entertaining the family the following weekend. At the time, I was oblivious to most of this. The name Elsie Kuhn Leitz meant little to me, just a woman my grandmother had worked for during the war. I am intent on starting some new project, as I have recently finished an article on the American poet Charles Olson. Olson spent part of the early 50s wandering the Yucatan, disillusioned by World War II, digging up the Mayan past with a shovel, looking for a remnant that might lead to a more hopeful future. It was an adventurous, physical endeavor, and I admire it. I am looking for a new project and consider Mina Loy, a British heroine of interwar modernism, who briefly joined up with a gang of avant-garde radicals called the Italian Futurists, whose major objective was to blow up the past and glorify the great technological future. Loy harnessed the futurists' energy and bombast, had affairs with both of the movement's leaders, subverted their aggressive aesthetics for her own artistic purposes, and promptly set off for interwar New York. There is a lot to like in this, and I scan an academic database searching for a place to start. It is possible that the argument upstairs had been going on for some time, dulled by the floor between us and the hum of air conditioning. But it was in this moment that I became aware of my mother and grandmother's voices. "Mom, what's this?"
"What's what?"
A strained innocence from my grandmother. "This bowl in the refrigerator."
"Oh, Lucy, you know, that just little bit meat for meat on stick."
"But we agreed I would make lasagna."
Lucy, listen. Lori and Jerry drive all way from Rochester to see us. Your brother drive across border from Lewiston, and no meat on a stick? No vareniki?
Mom, those Ukrainian foods are too much work. Too hard on your back.
Not so hard. I make only some.
You'll make a mountain. I know you. Let me make the lasagna. Something in one dish.
They drive so far to see us and you make only one dish?
I only mean it will be easier.
Jerry like meat on stick. Always his favorite.
Yes, and he'll like lasagna too, and so will Lori.
I know Lori since she 5 years old. In DP camp. She almost 70 now. Can't believe.
I know, Mom.
You and Sasha only visit me once a year. Who knows what happened next year? Terrible, terrible thing happened sometime.
The electricity of this exchange transmits itself on a current of cool air, causing me to look for my brown suitcase pressed in beside a stack of white plastic lawn chairs. I get up and nab a gift bag from the otherwise empty suitcase. My bare feet slap on the linoleum as I carefully hurry up the 3 stairs to the rec room, up another level to the back door, and one more short flight into the upstairs kitchen. The air is filled with the incriminating scent of garlic. Light streams over the sink through the kitchen's south-facing window, hitting the framed print of the Last Supper that hangs over the kitchen table. My mother and grandmother stand at opposite sides of the kitchen, not more than 4 feet apart. My grandmother in front of the white fridge, my mother beside the cabinets with the peekaboo view into the dining room beyond. My grandmother clutches a giant aluminum bowl of marinating meat cubes to her white lace blouse, a light blue scarf tied around her gray curls. My mother, 60 and looking all of 40, leans against the oven, her shoulder-length blonde hair spilling across her Harley Davidson t-shirt, which in turn brushes the top of fitted black jeans. In her right hand, she holds the box of lasagna noodles, and I can see her nails digging into the cardboard. I try inserting something into the moat of exasperation.
Baba, I got you something, I say, holding out the bag.
My grandmother places the bowl protectively on the counter behind her and wipes her hands with a dishcloth.
What is, Sasha?
She accepts the bag and pulls out a gauzy peach-colored scarf with lace edges, rubs the material between her thumb and forefinger, feeling for quality.
Beautiful, she murmurs. Thank you, Sashinka.
Will you wear it to church? I ask, knowing this is the ultimate venue for compliment exchange, the give and take of family trophies.
Oh, no. She says softly, too special. I put with my outfit.
Your outfit? For the lunch this weekend?
No, come with me. You too, Lucy.
This discussion isn't over, Mom, my mother says, tossing the box of lasagna noodles on the stovetop. You never understand when things are too much.
Ludini niamachni.
This last line, people are not machines, is something my grandmother likes to say to other people. She waves her hand dismissively and leads us up the cream-carpeted stairs to the bedrooms. Because we are following her, and only because we are following her, my grandmother pointedly uses the hand railing. The wall surfaces of the stairwell are crowded with photographs. The grandkids as children, my grandfather in his 60s sitting on a giant slide at the downtown amusement park. My mother and Uncle Alex as teenagers, all blue jeans and cheekbones. At the end of the hall, my grandmother turns into her talc-scented bedroom. She moves toward the closet, and my mother and I sit on the far side of the bed, the side my grandmother still sleeps on, turning to the closet doors. The peach bedspread is smooth under my hand. Quilted sateen, bought on sale at the Bay or Eaton's.
You know where is Lucy?
my grandmother asks, pulling on one of the closet's mirrored sliding doors. My special outfit. Always on left side my closet. She pulls a cream-colored linen dress off the rack. The dress hangs neatly on a wooden hanger underneath a clear plastic dry-cleaning bag. My grandmother presses the scarf against the plastic, examining the outfit critically for a moment.
Yes, perfect. See, I know.
Are you going to a wedding? I ask.
No,
she says, pleased.
This is outfit I buried in. Scarf look nice in coffin. Matches material I pick out for lining.
I wait for the punchline. But my grandmother is in earnest, the intelligent, hawkish cast of her profile intent on the assessment of her ensemble.
Open coffin in Ukrainian church, you know, Sasha. Need to look good.
My grandmother smooths an invisible wrinkle under the bag. Satisfied, she puts the dress back in the closet. Next, she carefully folds the scarf and places it on the hat shelf above the dress.
Be so nice,
my grandmother says with a sigh, her back still turned.
Be so nice to make big lunch with you and Sasha, Lucy, one last time.
I see my mother's mouth twitch, the hint of an eye roll. Mom, you've been saying that for 30 years. My grandmother chuckles, turns to face us.
But every year could be true.
Mom, no, it's okay. You don't want to make lunch all together. Mom, all special foods. Mom, we made a plan.
So plan change, Lucy. Plan in life change all time. Look at me. Graduated as school teacher in Kyiv. But then war come. I bury my teaching certificate under pear tree in village at home. German plane, bomb tree. Poof. No more teaching certificate. So, lunch menu change. That not such big change to plan.
My mother shakes her head, knowing she has been had, and so easily. My grandmother smiles then, and her dark eyes are mischievous and triumphant.
You do good job, Sasha,
my grandmother says, moving around the corner of the bed to pat my cheek. As she turns, she is framed in the closet mirror by the leaves of the birch trees outside the bedroom window. In most ways, the shift is unremarkable, a brightening of the light, a sudden greenness, a foreign field. June 1942, Wetzlar, Germany. The ground seems to rise and fall in an uncertain rhythm as Irena and the others are ordered out of the train cars and marched to a wire enclosure. In a confined cement area with other young women, Irena is ordered to strip. The girls and women are pushed into a disinfection area, pesticide showers, before being issued temporary shift dresses, clogs, and white and blue badges with the letters OST printed in the center. In a central assembly area, a guard, starched in his tailored uniform, barks sentences in German. A tall blonde woman with startling blue eyes stands beside him. She introduces herself in Ukrainian as Maria Halawata, the camp liaison. When the guard speaks again, Maria translates. They are now Ostarbeiter, Eastern workers. They will work for the glory of Hitler and the German people. Those who try to escape will be found. Those who do not work will be shot. After this orientation, the women are divided into metal-roofed barracks. Irena is assigned to a room with seven others, none from her village. At 4:30 the next morning, the women are roused, given 15 minutes to wash in the communal latrines, and issued a cup of water and a small piece of dark, dry bread. The laborers are then marched a half mile down the road. As they walk, Reina comes to understand the clogs. The clumping of their heels on the ground is as identifiable as a cow with a bell. The guards march the prisoners to one of two modern buildings, 10 stories tall, with a stern modern facade. Their building has the name Ernst Lights written at the top in large illuminated letters, bright in the dawn light. The women are divided into work units and given protective clothing. Irina is assigned to an assembly line where glass lenses are packed into cardboard boxes and then into plain wooden crates. The factory smells of nothing in particular, only a numbing efficiency. Every day, Irina stands beside the other women and packs 10 lenses to a box, 12 boxes to a crate. The crates are made of a light wood. The repetitive activity and cool glass are a comfort. The first week, Irina keeps her eyes down, looking at nothing but the glass lenses, the cardboard boxes, the wooden crates. Later, she watches the overseer as he strides along the rows of working women, snapping at a misstep or inefficiency. Irina spends 3 months packing lenses in the factory, days marked by turnip soup, the contractions of hunger pain, and cool, airless work in the factory. At night, in the half hour before the harsh overhead light goes out, she reads her translation dictionary and learns new words in German. Unterwasser, Gefühl, Flucht. She tries to think in sentences that take in more than what is immediately in front of her, but her brain feels stilted, stunned into emotionless observation. The dictionary, the metal bed frame, the fence. One morning, the overseer, a stout, gray-haired man in his 50s, who spends his time peering over the shoulders of the women standing too close, stops behind her.
"Why are you packing 8 lenses to a box instead of 10?
He asks roughly. He moves to pick up the box and show her what he means, but Irina responds,
"Because the boxes that arrived this morning are smaller, sir," she says. She has been waiting for this moment to use her German and is satisfied by the startled look on the overseer's face. He removes his glasses, polishes them with a small blue cloth, replaces them on his nose, looks at her again.
"Where did you learn German?"
"In school, sir."
2 days later, Irina is transferred to work in the camp hospital under a German doctor named Braun. She and several other German-speaking Ukrainian women translate between doctor and camp patients, wash and bandage wounds, and keep the facility clean. Sometimes the patients are the youngest workers in the camp, the 13- and 14-year-olds who suffer most from malnutrition. Other days, Irina tends to the newly interned who have been sprayed with the acid-based disinfectant that leaves large red burns on their backs, chests, and legs. One day, she holds the hand of a woman giving birth.
"Get it out! Get it out!" the woman screams. "It's German! Get it out of me! My baby! Where is my baby?"
Sometimes at the end of the day, Irina stands at the edge of the camp and looks out into the fields. The fields are endless and look like home. June 2011, Niagara Falls, Canada. The bowl of marinating meat, still cold from the fridge, sits in the center of the kitchen table. Its outside surface, warming in the light humidity of the kitchen, is covered in condensation. Inside the bowl, the 1-inch cubes of pork and beef marinate in garlic, evaporated milk, and egg. Meat on stick is originally a Cossack dish, though my grandmother substitutes satay sticks for swords, as well as other concessions to the suburban kitchen. The skewers are rolled in shake and bake, fried until the coating is dark and crispy,
and simmered in the oven in bouillon until soft. Despite her arthritic fingers, my grandmother is nimble at spearing the meat, knitting the skewer in and out of the folds of each.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?